Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm and author of Investing Simplified, the book. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial show in America, with a financial advisor, an estate planning attorney, and a CPA to answer your questions for free, and is broadcast live from Portland, Oregon on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck with a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com. Or you can call him right now at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. Or for our long distance and podcast listeners, you can call toll free at 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
Well, welcome to Investing Simplified. It's a cold Saturday morning, and in studio with me is Kevin Stege with the Baker Colson CPA firm.
Good morning, morning Chuck. Kevin.
And on the line, we have Carl Jepson with the Carl Jepson Law Firm.
Well, I'm in the studio in spirit today.
Okay. So. Well, you sound like you're in the studio, so nobody would know.
No, they were,
except you just told them.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we're here to take your calls. I'm going to give a quick stock update here, and I want to talk to everybody about this because I think there's a lot of euphoria going on about the Trump election, and you know, a lot of talk about the Trump rally, and the Trump rally really is, as far as I'm concerned, we're playing catch up because unless you live in a cave, you understand that this has been the worst recovery in history. Mathematically, it's been the worst recovery in history, and. When they talk about job creation, when half the jobs are part-time jobs, I think you have to cut the job numbers in half because there's just too many part-time jobs. Hopefully, we're going to change that around. But I think the thing that people really need to think about is what is going on in the world and what's going on in the economy of America. And our indexes are primarily world indexes now. They're no longer, you know, the S&P 500 is really no longer an American index. It's an international index. Same thing with the Dow. Many of these companies make way more money outside the United States than they do inside the United States. So you need to be aware of that when you're investing, because what that means is the word volatility. And depending on your risk factors, how much volatility you can take, you need to be careful with the market, because a sudden downside of 30, 40% or 50% and a recovery of 5.5 years can get you wondering why you even got in the market at all. And the idea to invest is to have some gains and successes, not to risk it all and get yourself in a beat-up position, because that's not a good way to invest. And we find that people that we do 401k plans, we find that people that have retirement plans, we tell them to start small, build it up. You know, even if you start at $50 a month or $100 a month or $500 a month, start slow, build it up, and eventually be putting max it out if you can. Absolutely. But again, starting slow, building it up, having some successes, dollar cost averaging into the market is one of the greatest ways for young people to save money. And I think it's going to be true in this coming year. I think we are going to have, at some point in time, we're going to have a fallback. And we're going to have a dip. And the real key is, how is the market going to recover to the key? I'll give you some key things I'm looking at. I'm looking at April, when they're going to have to consider extending the debt. You know, the $20 trillion in debt. Are we going to go to 22? Are we going to go to 25? What's the number? I don't know. But I know one thing, it's not pretty. and we got to get it reduced, and we got to get it paid off. Now, for all you people out there that are investing your money, and if you work in one of these places, I can actually now help you manage your 401k or your 403b. If you work at Peace Health Hospitals in Vancouver, if you work at or any of the Peace Health Hospitals, Adventist Hospitals, Legacy Hospitals, OHSU, Kaiser Northwest Permanente Hospitals, Fidelity and Vanguard are both good. State of Oregon Savings and Growth 457 Plan, and various public schools, Portland, Lake Oswego, Beaverton, West Lynn, Wilsonville, et cetera. If you're in the 457 or tax-sheltered annuity, we can help you with those. And also, what's really great is if you have $100,000 or more in your 401k plan, and you work for Intel, HP, UPS, AT&T, or Alaska Airlines, we can help you invest that money. And we have not been able to do that up until this year, but we're going to be able to do that. And a lot of this comes with giving choice to the individual investor in their 401k plan and giving them options of managed money, not just a bunch of mutual funds to pick and pick blindly with no advice. And so if you work for one of those companies and you need some help and you have over $100,000 in your 401k, we can actually access that and help you manage it on a managed portfolio. But again, I'm going to answer some questions because I had a lot, you know, the weather's been kind of bad and I'm trying to catch up on my emails here. I have an email question. Can you please explain the difference in coverages between FDIC, which insures $250K at the bank, and SIPC, that insures $500K at a brokerage? As I understand it, the latter covers if the brokerage fails due to fraud or mismanagement. Okay, let me explain this to you. FDIC is backed by the federal government. And obviously, if the FDIC were to fail and they don't have enough reserves, actually, I believe we have 10 banks too big to fail. If one of those 10 banks failed, FDIC would be broke. So the reality is, if the FDIC went broke and you're covered up to $250,000, that's dollar on dollar of your money in the bank or in a credit union. FDIC is backed by the government. They're going to filter that money to the government. They're going to add it to our national debt. We're going to pay it if that happens. You know, say one of the top 10 banks crashed and they had to bail them out, that all of us would be bailing them out, the taxpayers. Now, SIPC coverage, and again, you said 500K, but many, many brokerage firms insure the accounts for much more than 500K, 500K per account. Some are $1.5 million, some are $5 million, some are $10 million, depending on what kind of account you have and what the broker clearing that you're clearing through. But and also, there's options to increase if you are feared of it. But the thing I like about SIPC insurance, it does not protect you for gains and losses or losses of principal. If you invested and took a risk and you lost, that's it. Too bad. What it protects you on is theft or fraud from your account or from the people managing your account. And if they were to steal money out of your account, SIPC would come in, put some people in jail, get that money put back in your account, and you'd be taken care of. Or they fraudulently sold you an investment that was totally fraudulent. That's called Bernie Madoff with your money. And Bernie deserves to be in jail a long, long time. And so do all his compadres. Unfortunately, most of them escaped. So does the guy who investigated him from the SEC, who waited 3.5 years to say anything, ought to be in jail too and not lose his fat pension plan. But I digress. Anyway, I hope that answers your question. If it doesn't, just go ahead and feel free to give me a call back. I also have another one here. Now, I'm taking this off of investingsimplifiedradio.com, where you can actually look at the question. You can see actually what I'm reading, or you can ask a question. It says, investing psychology question. Why do retirees who have retirement income, pension plus Social Security plus interest dividends that greatly exceeds their expenses still want to trade and try to beat the market, both with their money, serious money? these folks could stay at near zero interest their whole life and never run out of money. Given your 40 years plus in the business, hundreds of clients, you are in the best position to answer. Thanks. Well, here's why. No matter how much money you have, you're still in the recesses of your mind, particularly the older you get, the more you're afraid of losing it and end up with nothing. I could tell you, I've had clients, Carl, you and I have had clients who are multimillionaires that will not spend any money because they're so afraid they're going to run out of money. And they still invest, and they put money, even though I know they may put it at risk, but not at high risk, but maybe a low risk, but they still invest it because they're concerned about their money not growing and not keeping up with inflation and not keeping up with the economy. So great question there, but that's just a fact of life. As we get older, we get more and more conservative with our money. And people, as they get older, you know, you kind of say, well, gee, my folks did that. Am I going to do that? Yeah, you probably are. I mean, I see clients now that I had that their mom and dad wouldn't spend any money, and they're the exact same way. And I try to tell them, I say, hey, look, you remember when we talked about your mom and dad 35 years ago? You now are your dad, you know? And so, and as I am, you know, we all are. We all follow in that. That's human nature. But people who have money generally are wise investors and tend to be way more conservative than the average investor. They just don't take risk. They don't take a lot of risk because they don't want to. They've earned their money, however they got their money, they just don't want to lose it. So they tend to be conservative investors, but still continue to invest. And there are some people who have all their money in CDs at the bank, and they're getting 0.2%. They're in a money market account, and you know what? If they can live on that and they're happy with that, more power to them because they can sleep at night. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come right back with a question on the line there. We're going to come back with the tax, or actually Carl's comments we're going to come back with, and we'll be right back. I will be just like all the rest, like all the rich men who have been blessed. Nothing succeeds like success.
All right. I'm Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and co-host of the radio program Investing Simplified. I recently left the Warren Allen Law Firm to open my own office. Professional and personable service have always been the hallmarks of my practice. I believe that this move will allow me to spend more time with my clients. For more than 37 years, it has been my privilege to assist clients with practical estate planning with wills, trusts, powers of attorney, advance directives, and other documents so that they may have peace of mind knowing that their affairs are in order. When probate becomes necessary, emotions of family members may become fragile. Having an experienced attorney that can empathize with what the client is going through makes the process much easier. My new office is conveniently located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 101, just across from Mall 205, and my phone number is 971-229-0585. That's 971-229-0585.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl now at 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Okay, Carl, we've got a caller on the line there, too, Carl. Janice has a question about bonds.
Okay, well, you're the bond guy.
Good morning.
Good morning, Janice.
Yes. I've always heard, and you've talked the same way, that when interest goes up, bonds go down. And I do see that a little bit in my portfolio. I have two tax-free, Oregon tax-free bonds. And I was wondering, at what point do you say we need to get rid of it and go into something else, and what should you go into?
Well, that's a really good question, because here's the key thing about an Oregon tax-free bond. You're in Oregon, so of course that's double tax-free on state and federal income taxes. And are you in a high tax bracket?
No.
Okay.
So, no.
Okay, then you bought the tax-free bond just to get the interest income, not for the tax savings.
Well, both, I would say.
Okay, but you're no longer in a higher tax bracket.
No.
Okay, I would look at those bonds, because I think what's going to happen, depending on the interest rate that you have on them, what rate do you have? Are you getting like 3, 4?
I don't really know. I didn't know that it was based on a...
Yeah, they have a guaranteed... Here's the thing about a bond. Let's say you've got a $100,000 bond. Well, let's keep it simple. $10,000 bond that pays 5%. That's $500 a year. That bond is going to pay $250 every 6 months to you in tax-free income. Now, the bond principal, let's say you've got that at 5%, and interest rates start going up. Well, that bond principal is going to go down, but those 5% payments are always going to be based on the original $10,000. No matter what the value of that bond is, those payments are going to be based on the value of that original $10,000. And then when that bond matures, Oregon will give you back your cash, and you can get a different bond or something else.
Maybe I've misquoted. I'm not aware that my bond will mature.
Do you have a mutual fund, or is it a bond? Is it an actual separate bond?
Well, it's by itself, yes. But I'm not aware that it'll ever, if I make a move on it, it'll ever mature.
Well, where do you get your statements from the bond at?
Lord Abbott.
Well, Lord Abbott is a mutual fund company.
Oh, okay.
So it sounds like to me you've got a tax-free bond fund.
Okay.
That's a whole different story. That's a whole different story. You don't own the individual bond. Nothing in your bond portfolio is guaranteed at all.
Okay.
So you're no interest rates, no dividend rates, nothing is guaranteed, because that's a mutual fund. And what you're doing is you're giving money to Lord Abbott, and Lord Abbott are buying and selling bonds and trying to get you yields and gains on bonds that they're buying and selling to have that thing make some money for you. The last couple of years, it probably has not.
Well, and I would say more recently than that, it's done very well, I thought.
Well, that's great then. Yeah. Are you in Lord Abbott Bond Debenture?
I don't think so.
Okay. What's the name of the fund?
It may be Lord Abbott.
Yeah. If you get your statements from Lord Abbott, it should say right on the statement what the name of the fund is.
Yeah. I'm looking here real quickly.
Now, Lord Abbott Bond Debenture is a fund. And it's one of the funds that Lord Abbott has, and that has some high yield bonds and some they do some debentures and convertible bonds on there that actually it almost acts like an equity fund instead of a bond fund. So when interest rates are going up, that principal and that Lord Abbott bond debenture is going up. It's going up with the interest rates. So it's different. It's different than a normal bond fund. So that's why I ask you, because all companies have a wide range of different investment vehicles in their funds.
Right.
So that's kind of what you got.
Well, I think I'm looking here, and one specifies it on my paper, and the other one does. I'm not looking at the statement, but it's a Franklin, Oregon tax-free.
Okay, Franklin, Oregon tax-free is a mutual fund. All in tax-free bonds, and that's been one of the longer ones in Oregon, and has done pretty well.
Right, I thought so.
Yeah, it's done very well. And if you want tax-free interest, that's the place to be. I think over the next few years, however, I think if you're not in a high tax bracket, I think the advantage of having the tax-free fund is going to go away. and your advantage is going to be more investing in an equity or something that has more growth. But are you retired?
Yes.
Okay. Nice thing about that, that fund doesn't fluctuate a lot even when rates jump up. That fund has been a really good fund. Do you take the interest?
No.
Yeah. Well, what I would suggest you do is call into your company and ask them to give you the cost basis, what your actual cost basis is, and what your fund's worth. And that'll tell you your gain.
Well, I do know that from month to month.
Oh, okay.
It always has been, I thought, very acceptable. Lately, it's fluctuated down a little bit, and then it'll go up a tiny bit. But it's on the way down, I thought, because interest rates are possibly going to be changing.
You know, I actually don't think rates are going to jump up a lot. I think they're going to go up a little bit. I think maybe we get to 4.5 on mortgages, maybe 5.
Oh, yeah. And
I think that's because, I'll tell you why. We got a $20 trillion debt. If they keep jacking that rate up, we won't have enough revenue just to pay the debt interest.
What does that do for CD rates, for example? I have several.
Well, I think CD rates will be coming up a little bit. They'll be coming up a little bit.
Yeah.
We're going to have to move the rates up a little bit, but we got to be careful. We can't move them up too fast or too much because we don't have enough revenue to pay the debt interest on the $20
trillion. Probably I should just leave my bonds alone and just take the fluctuation as it comes.
Yeah, if you bought that for the income and you don't, it's going to give you a very solid return. That's been a really good fund for a long time.
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay.
All right.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for the call. Okay, we're going to get to Carl. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit today about, once upon a time, I gave a list of things you should do soon after somebody died. Well, I'm going to now give a little list of things that you don't have to do or you shouldn't do soon after somebody dies. And I have 10 of them.
Yeah, let Carl know.
10. So I'll start with number one, and you all can join in with me if you wish. And hopefully these prove helpful. Number one, when somebody dies, you don't have to pay all the bills right away. Relax. Being a little bit late is not going to damage the decedent's credit rating. So the thought on that is, I know that when people die, it seems like their closest relatives, they want to run out and get everything done like yesterday. And that may or may not be a wise choice. Now, granted, there may be some emergency kinds of things that need to be done, but that shouldn't be the number one focus. The first focus should be getting kind of organized and, you know, getting the funeral thing done and all of that sort of thing. So that would be one thing to do. And number two, don't start giving things away to your family members, even if everybody says it's okay. Because, you know, if you're a personal representative, you could end up being personally responsible for some of that stuff. So that's not a good idea. And a lot, it's very common to reach out there. So, Chuck, I'm sure that you've seen some times where, you know, the families run around and give all of the little goodies to everybody. Are you still there, Chuck?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Okay. I don't hear a whole lot of things going on. So I'm going to, this is the awkwardness of being off-site. Well, okay, number three. Unless the people are extraordinarily trustworthy, don't let people move into the house. You know, I mean, the next thing you know, you've got a biker gang living in your house. You know, I mean, you just got to be really careful with that. More often than not, people are fairly careful. But, you know, if you're going to be a personal representative or you're going to be responsible, you've got to be really cautious with that. Number four, don't drive the decedent's car around. I know that's really tempting. And, you know, but remember, you got along without that car before the decedent died. So it's important to just kind of leave that thing alone for a while. Don't try to rush anything. There's kind of a corollary to that little rule. And that is, you know, if you want to sell the, you're the personal representative, and you want to sell the car to one of the relatives, that's okay so long as it's fair market value. But it's also, you know, got to be done in the context of the of the probate, and it's got, you know, it's got to be fair market value. And if you're going to do that kind of thing, you want to go out and get all of the heirs' consent to doing it, because otherwise you're going to find yourself looking down the barrel of an unhappy heir who thought they were going to get the car. So anyway, just a thought. Cars are things that can wait in terms of trouble well, there might be one exception, but trouble for the heirs and the personal representative. Number five, if you're a joint account holder with the decedent, and you're going to be paying things, expenses for the decedent, make sure that you keep really good records. Don't reimburse yourself just willy-nilly, and don't assume necessarily that the things that you're spending money on are really reimbursable expenses. Sometimes people, you know, spend it on stuff that, you know, just really might not fit. So the best way to do that is, you know, obviously things like funeral expenses and things like that, that's fine. But going beyond that much, it ends up being a little troublesome sometimes. So I would just be cautious and take your time doing that stuff. And best to have your lawyer review, you know, call a lawyer, set up a time, even if there's no probate involved, you know, and find out, you know, how that might work. And it's all an individual kind of basis sort of thing that happens on those deals. Number six, if you're the personal representative and you're named in the will, you know, don't assume that you have legal authority to really do anything, because ordinarily the personal representative, you might be named in the will, but you're not really appointed until the court appoints you. And then you have legal authority to do all sorts of stuff. But you know, and if you're a take charge kind of person, it's really easy to say, well, I'm the personal representative, I can do whatever I want. Beware that way of thinking. Number seven, if you're the personal representative, don't refuse to give the other relatives a copy of the will, or if you're the trustee of the trust, or to tell them what's going on in the estate. Because I can tell you this from experience, hiding the ball is always interpreted by the others, other heirs, to mean that you're stealing stuff. So just beware. Number eight, if you're the personal representative or trustee, and your know-it-all relative from Pawtucket, Rhode Island, shows up and he or she doesn't like the way you're running things, blame it on the lawyer. You know, the lawyer told me not to do that. The lawyer told me I had to do that. Relatives like that are sometimes called seagulls, and they kind of fly in and fly out, and they leave a big mess, and don't usually add a lot of help to it. So consider that as one technique to at least make it a little easier to deal with. It's much easier to blame the lawyer. Number nine, don't let other relatives provide cleanup or repair services or anything like that to the decedent's home without first discussing it with the probate attorney, because you never know. A lot of times this stuff ends up with, it's kind of like sometimes happens in a construction dispute. You know, all of a sudden, you know, they're expecting payment for stuff that you never even realized they did. Or they're doing stuff that they that you didn't want them to, and the next thing you know, they're mad at you as the personal representative, and they want to be paid more, a whole lot more money than they should, and it's just a bad thing to do until you've got it all in hand in a probate situation where you have some legal authority to do stuff. And quite frankly, if you're going to have people doing that, and they're going to be doing it for, you know, some amount of money, or they're going to be doing it for no money, you know, you want to have some kind of writing that tells you that this is what the deal is. And I have now bored you all the way down to number 10. And I told you there was one exception about the decedent's car. And that is, if there is a 1967 Shelby Cobra in the garage, locate the ignition keys and deliver them to the lawyer immediately.
Especially if his name is Carl, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if there's no Cobra, but there's another, you know, 1960s and 70s muscle car in vintage condition, same thing. Deliver the keys immediately to the lawyer. And that's Carl Cummins.
Ah, wow. Okay. Hey, listen, speaking about that, we've got Tom on the line. Tom's in Money Market. He's got a question. Tom, are you there?
Yes.
Thanks for holding on, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. I listened to you before, and I put my retirement money in a money market just to be safe before the elections, but now it seems like Trump has made the market strong. Should I try to ease my way back into the stock market, or is doom and gloom still coming that you and Harry are just talking about?
Well, I still think we're going to have a correction in the market sometime between now and October, and only because those are the times usually it happens. So I think we're going to have it, and it has nothing to do with Trump. I think it has everything to do with the national debt, the $20 trillion-plus we're going to have by the time we hit April. So I think a lot of that's going to be troublesome, because those are going to be areas he's going to have to rook. However, I got to tell you, I don't think anybody in the investment world that I know of predicted that Trump was going to win. I may have wanted him to win, but doesn't mean that he's going to win. And I think the Trump win caught a lot of people by surprise. And boy, I'll tell you, the market's reacted very well to it. And about half the gains for 2016 came after the election. So there's definitely an upswing to it, and that is an automatic. But I can't tell you when, but I think we're going to have another correction, and I think it's going to be between now and October. Next Saturday, we got Rodney Johnson on live with us, and that's one of the things I'm going to talk to Rodney about is looking at those numbers, because many people, and since you listen to our show, you probably know that we started talking about this back in 15. Back in May 15, we crossed over some numbers that Harry had talked about, and it's kind of interesting because when we crossed those numbers, since May 21st of 2015, the S&P is only up 2.8%, and the Dow is up 8.16. Now, but that's a year and a half. And then the NASDAQ is only up 6.8, and those are over 18 months. So that's not a big gain. So this market is really just kind of puff right now, and I think we are going to have a correction. And listen next Saturday, because we got Rodney Johnson on, and he'll give you more hard facts than I can.
Okay, yeah. I thought first 100 days might be strong market, but I don't know how that's going to work with your opinion on that.
Well, I think we're going to have some upswing between now and maybe June or July, but sometime between summer and October, I think we're going to have that correction. And I can't tell you when, but I know one thing, it's going to be a great opportunity to buy. It's going to be a great opportunity to buy low. Yeah. Hey, thank you very much. We're going to take a quick break. Thank you. Thank you, Tom. And we're going to come right back with Investing Simplified with the tax investigator.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask Kevin Stege, CPA and shareholder of the Baker Colson CPA firm, that tax question that's been keeping you up at night. You can call Kevin 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's the CPA with the tax answers, Kevin Stege.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified, and Chuck, I thought I'd maybe start out with asking you a quick question following Tom's question. you know, if we do have a downturn. I read recently that hedge funds have had over $1 billion withdrawn by their investors over the last, I don't know, quarter or something like that. Do you think if, it seems like there's a lot of cash on the sidelines right now even.
Oh, there's a ton of cash.
Yeah. And so it seems like if there is a downturn, potentially we're going to have a quicker recovery. People should probably, I mean, you hate to buy in if it's only halfway, halfway down to the drop, but it seems like it's going to be one that people will want to pay attention to.
I'm really anxious to talk to Rodney about this because that's kind of my feeling right now is that there's a lot of cash on the sidelines, and when this thing does go down, I think you're going to see a lot of people jumping in and putting a lot of money back in the market, which will push it right back up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's good. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's bad. I think that's good.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all want the market to do well. We all want the economy to do well. You know, I wanted the economy to do well under Obama. I want the economy to do well under any president because that affects all of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking about that, I got a question for you.
Sure.
Because one of our listeners sent in on our website here on InvestingSimplifiedRadio.com. Can a U.S. citizen working overseas earning money in the local currency but paying U.S. taxes on their earnings put money into an IRA?
Off the top of my head, I would say I don't see why not. I would want to definitely look at that. But, you know, you're being taxed on it. You're going to convert that to U.S. dollars. You're going to report it on your tax return. You may get a foreign tax credit, earned income, foreign earned income credit. And I think if everything else is in place, it seems to me you'd be able to make an IRA contribution. But that would be one you'd just definitely want somebody to get chapter and verse for you out of the...
Well, knowing how illogical the tax code is, I was going to say it almost was automatic that, yeah, you can do it. But sometimes it's not that way.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah,
good advice.
Yeah. Well, hey, I was chatting with somebody, and I didn't get this report firsthand. One of my partners at work, he was mentioning he had seen a study or heard something on the radio that Oregon was not listed as one of the great places to retire. And one of the reasons for that, and it was mainly non-tax purposes, a few of the reasons were doctors are 25% higher than the national average. Gas is 30% higher than the national average. And rent, if you're renting, is 50% higher than the national average.
You're kidding. I had no idea.
No. So these are, and I'm just trying to remember off the top of my head, but those are pretty significant cost of living levels above the national average. And then on top of that, of course, Oregon's going to tax your retirement income, where places like Washington or there's other states without income tax won't tax it. And then when you die, they're going to take 10% or more of everything over $1 million. So maybe Oregon isn't as friendly.
Well, I wouldn't think Oregon for retirement, although I have, you know, numerous clients who have worked in Portland, or in Portland area, Vancouver area. And then when they retire, some of them buy a place up in Central Oregon and then buy a place down in Arizona or Palm Springs, and they go back and forth, and they have kind of the best of all worlds because they have a wonderful summer up here.
In Central Oregon.
And a great winter down there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, Oregon's got, you know, Oregon's the only place I can think of you can play out in the sun and look up at snow-covered mountains. I mean, it's gorgeous sometimes when you're playing golf. You can look up, and especially if you're over in Central Oregon, and look up at the mountain range and see all that snow and think, wow,
yep,
what a beautiful place.
Yep, a little over an hour to the oceans, a little over an hour to the mountains, so not too bad.
Yeah, and you know, really, we have a lot of great things in Portland. Of course, Portland just has basketball and hockey, but you know, not that far away are the Seattle Mariners or the Seattle Seahawks.
Yep, with a big game today.
Yeah.
Hey, so I wanted to talk today on the Tax Investigator, just give our listeners a little bit of insight into related party transactions. You hear that term thrown around. What does that really mean?
Is that like getting another drink at the bar?
Oh, I had never thought of that.
You said party transactions.
Related party transactions.
Oh, okay.
That's when you buy your friends a drink at the bar.
Oh, okay.
Something like
okay.
that. I don't know. Yeah. So related party transactions generally are transactions that are further regulated by the IRS because with a related party, you can manipulate a transaction in a non-fair market value kind of way to your benefit. Now, I'll give our listeners an example. Say you bought a house for $100,000 and it has dropped to, or in any investment, $100,000. It's dropped it's gone up to $200,000, and you're going to sell it to your child for $50,000. Well, you bought it for $100,000 and you sold it for $50,000. You would get a $50,000 loss in this type of scenario without the related party rules. And then the child would go ahead and, sell, especially if it was like a house worth $200,000, they're going to live in it 2 years, sell it. It's going to be tax-free, and you would have got a $50,000 loss. So there's ways you can manipulate stuff. There's probably a gift involved for a sale below fair market value in that scenario. But most related party transactions are related to the loss is non-deductible to the original, to the seller, to the original purchaser who ends up selling
it. So what you're saying is if you did that, then you would not be able to write the $50,000 off.
Well, what happens is the child, he paid $50,000 for it. That's his basis. And then the $50,000 that you didn't get goes to him also. And typically you give him a statement.
Oh, he carries forward your cost basis.
Yeah. So the child would actually end up with the – it basically undoes your sham transaction and makes it as if the child sold it for – $200,000 with 100 basis.
No advantage at all.
Exactly. And so that's what generally it does is that suspended loss or disallowed loss goes to.
And, if you really think about it, that's only fair.
It is.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's kind of like half a gift.
Say that again, Carl?
It's kind of like half a gift.
Yeah, exactly.
you got half of the value, and then the other half is a gift. You bought half of the value, another half is a gift.
Yep, exactly. And in general, when you're selling something below fair market value, there's reasons that that can occur. Maybe it's a hard to move asset, and you're giving a discount. Maybe you have somebody who's already in a place. And that in those cases, that's not a gift. If there's an asset in an estate and they're trying to move it, there was one scenario where there was some land that somebody had been farming, a low-income farmer had been farming for decades, and the decedent had really liked this person, and it was out in the middle of nowhere, and the appraisal came in at such and such, but he basically sold it cheaply to that farmer because. How are you going to get somebody else to come in and buy this strange piece of real estate that just wasn't marketable?
You're not going to.
Yeah. So there's no gift or anything there. That's just a discounted sale. But if there's truly a fair market value and for one reason or another, you're really giving somebody a discount, then you have to consider whether a gift of has happened in this scenario. So just some things to plan. There's really, I don't think, any set definition of when you've sold something and it's a gift. When it's below fair market value, it's one of these kind of gray areas that you just have to consider with your attorney.
Yeah, you really should do it before you do the transaction because, of course, I would think the odds of getting caught, unless you had an estate tax problem, probably wouldn't.
Yeah.
You might, though. Who knows?
I mean, yeah. And one last detail on related party transactions. Who is a related party? Related party is pretty much going to be any immediate family. It's not going to be, and I had my list here, and of course, it's the book is closed, and now I can't find it. But if you're looking at, second cousins, you're okay. But if you're talking, grandparents, children, grandchildren, half brothers and sisters, that type of thing, then you're in a related party situation and something, your loss is not going to be typically do.
Well, I would think, yeah, especially if you're trying to write the loss off.
Yeah.
You're going to have a tough row to hoe on that one.
Exactly. And that is the tax investigator for today.
Okay. Well, listen, if you've got a question, pick up the phone, give us a call, 503-417-9595. Toll free, 877-733-1011. We'll be right back with the Knowledge Trust. You're listening to Investing Simplified on the Investing Simplified Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Beer is good. People are crazy. We do Investing Simplified.
Hi, everybody. Chuck Price, the financial doctor here. If you're between ages 58 and 68, choosing Social Security benefits at the right time is one of the biggest financial decisions you'll ever make. You get one chance to get it right. After 12 months, there are no do-overs. 74% of Americans receive reduced benefits. Get your free report on 44 Social Security secrets at pfgwm.com. Social Security is often one of the largest and most mismanaged assets in your retirement income plan. Claiming benefits sounds easy. So is leaving up to $250,000 of your money with the government, or reducing your benefits up to 76% over your life expectancy. For this vital information, go online to pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.
We do Investing Simplified.
Investments, tax questions, or legal concerns? Get them all answered now for free. Call Chuck, Kevin, or Carl for your answers. Call 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's the Knowledge Trust.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is the time of the show when we answer your questions. If you want to give us a call, pick up the phone and give us a call at 503-417-9595, toll free 877-733-1011. You know, Carl, just to let you know, the I went by the office this morning and it is a sheet of ice. Washington,
yeah.
and it's just a sheet of ice out there. And for you out there driving, 84 from 205 is a sheet of ice. It is, I'm not kidding, you got to go really slow. And, you know, there's few idiots out there, but like Kevin was saying, you could see some places where people slid into the rail.
There's at least five places where the snowbank in the into the barrier were clearly had some action.
Yeah, so you want to be very careful. If you're driving 84, and I would say if you're heading east of 42nd, probably, and east of 42nd, out to 205, and I don't know what it is after the 205. It might even be worse out east, but I can tell you from the 205 in, and for some reason, the ramps on coming off of Washington Street and off of Gleason there, they didn't do the northbound ramps, and those ramps are sheets of ice. I mean, they are really slick, and I've got a four-wheel drive unit, and I can tell you they don't do any good in ice, and they slide just like everything else. So you got to go slow. And I slid a little bit there on the on-ramp coming onto it, and I was really kind of surprised because, boy, it was a sheet of ice. So if you don't have to get out, I wouldn't do it today.
And stay in, enjoy the football games, and live to drive another day.
Yeah, and if you want to feel really good. Turn on the Golf Channel and watch golf. They're playing in Hawaii, and it's probably 75 degrees and sunny, and it just, you know, give you a good feeling about looking at TV and seeing that nice warm weather. So might warm you up a little bit.
You know, Carl, we've had two times over the last 2 weeks that's kind of been brought up about timing and trying to get an estate wrapped up as quick as possible. You know, from a tax perspective, I would say it is nice to have an estate wrapped up by December 31st of the year following the year of death. That gives us enough time to make elections, decide which tax years we, a fiscal year end. You can pick a fiscal year end with an estate. Anytime you go over 2 years, the IRS needs a separate statement saying why the estate is open for over 2 years, and you have to keep doing that. And a lot of times there's a hard to transfer or sell asset or something. I mean, you've run into those, Carl. But, you know, there's no hurry, but, you know, a year and a half should be enough time to get things done, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in most cases, I would say the average estate that we run into, again, this like you said, without something fairly unusual, is probably, I'd say the average would be 7 to 8 months.
Okay.
Some, you know, the earliest you could possibly do it here in Oregon would be, if it's a probate, would be, you know, like 5 months. But I'd say average would be, you know, and that depends on the simplicity of the assets. A lot of, like you said, sometimes if you have, you know, something that's really hard to get rid of, or, you know, or if they're, you know, like if you have like multiple heirs, and you know, are you going to say there's some piece of real property that's just, you know, a dog, you know, that just has, you know, maybe it's got an EPA problem or something, and you're trying to do something with it, can't sell it. And so, you know, you want to give it to your heirs, and they are saying, heck, I don't want that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you got to do something with it.
Yep.
And that could be a problem. But by and large, I'd say 8 months is a pretty good average. And it is frustrating sometimes because, you know, there are a lot of parts that come into these things sometimes with different kinds of assets and different people. And a lot of times people, and I understand it, that they're anxious to get, you know, the thing done, number one. They want some closure on the whole, you know, death of the loved one. But then there are the vulture sorts of relatives who, you know, it's like the TV or that TV commercial. You see the guy say, you know, it's my money, I want it now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, you know, you get a lot of those guys, and you know, they don't see why it should take so long, but. You know, the other thing is a lot of times the personal representative is working a full time job, or they're trying to do all of this stuff on, you know, getting things sold and getting things inventoried and you know, all of that kind of stuff, and they're working a full time job. They're trying to take care of their family all at the same time. You know, they're trying to administer this estate, and that's a really big challenge. And you can't expect them to be able to get it done. Yeah, if you were working full time as doing nothing but the personal representative, you might be able to get it done in 4 months. But,
yeah.
Not, the normal person doesn't do that. And
yeah.
So you got some slack. And I always get a little annoyed at the people who get in a big hurry because, you know, they say, well, why did you wait 3 weeks to do that? Well, you know, duh, I had the flu or whatever, you know. I mean, it's just like I had to take care of the kids with the flu or
yeah.
You know, had to work overtime at work and can't get there and all sorts of stuff. So,
yeah.
So, Be kind to your personal representative or trustee because, you know, you got to remember, generally speaking, they're an heir or a beneficiary too. They want that money too, and they're not gonna slow it down deliberately just so that you can't get your money. They want their money too. So, you know,
One of the things I see for an asset that happens more times than you would think is real property that has been titled into the name of the first spouse to die, or at least part of it is in that person's estate. The surviving spouse was the personal rep. They never got it untitled out of that decedent. Then that person died, and now you've got two estates messing around with. Yeah, and that tends to slow things down.
Yeah, and that does happen.
It does happen, and it
can be a real awkward thing. And those things can be easily remedied with some pre-planning. So,
well,
sure.
Carl, we got about a minute to go. How does somebody get a hold of you?
Well, they can call me at 971-229-0585, or I am on the web at carljepsonlaw.com.
Kevin?
I am at BakerandColson.com, Baker-Colson.com, 503-666-5569.
And I'm at PFGWM.com at 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. I just want to give you a quick plug here. If you want to get, check out InvestingSimplifiedRadio.com, We've got some resources on there for you. Also, next Saturday, Harry Dent, Dent Research, we're going to have Rodney Johnson on live on the air. So we'll talk to you then. Talk to you next Saturday. Bye-bye. Drive safe and be careful.
You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. How often do you have a checkup? Annually? Only when you're not feeling your best? Or are you one who waits until there is an emergency condition? High blood pressure, rapid pulse, or sleepless nights could be the result of your investment portfolio or no estate plan. But there is a specialist ready to offer you a checkup on your financial health.
Paging Dr. Price. Paging Dr. Price.
Chuck Price, the financial doctor and author of Investing Simplified, is offering you a free financial checkup. Whether you're asking for a second opinion, a complete financial physical, or investment stress test, Chuck Price, the financial doctor, can help diagnose your money ailments and prescribe a prudent path towards healthy investments and peace of mind. Call 503-253-3000 to schedule your financial checkup or on the web at pfgwm.com. That's pfgwm.com. You'll feel better.